Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. My father's family name being Pirrip, and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip, and came to be called Pip. I give Pirrip as my father's family name on the authority of his tombstone, as I never saw my father or my mother, and never saw those five little brothers of mine, whose five little stone lozenges were arranged in a neat row beside their grave. Ours was the marsh country down by the river, within 20 miles of the sea. My first, most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon, towards evening. At such a time I found out for certain that this bleak place overgrown with nettles was the churchyard, and that the small bundle of shivers growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry was Pip.
"Hold your noise!"
cried a terrible voice, as a man started up from among the graves at the side of the church porch.
"Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat."
A fearful man, all in coarse grey, with a great iron on his leg, and smothered in mud, seized me by the chin.
"Oh, don't cut my throat, sir. Please don't do it, sir."
"Tell us your name, quick."
Pip, sir."
"Ah, and who do you live with, supposing you're kindly let to live, which I haven't made up my mind about?"
"My sister, sir, Mrs. Joe Gargery, wife of Joe Gargery the blacksmith, sir."
"Blacksmith, eh?"
said he, and looked down at his leg.
"Now looky here, the question being whether you're to be let to live. You know what a file is?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you know what whittles is?"
"Yes, sir."
"You get me a file, and you get me whittles. You bring them both to me tomorrow morning early at that old battery over yonder. You do it, and you never dare to say a word or dare to make a sign concerning your having seen such a person as me, or any person some ever, and you shall be let live. You fail, or you go from my words in any particular, no matter how small it is, and your heart and your liver shall be tore out, roasted, and et. Now, I ain't alone, as you may think I am. There's a young man hid with me, in comparison with which young man I am a angel. That young man hears the words I speak. That young man has a secret way peculiar to himself of getting at a boy, and at his heart, and at his liver. Now, what do you say?"
I said that I would get him the file, and I would get him what bits of food I could, and I would come to him at the battery early in the morning. I set my face towards home, and made the best use of my legs, and ran home without stopping. Joe's forge adjoined our house. When I ran home from the churchyard, the forge was shut up, and Joe was sitting alone in the kitchen in the chimney corner.
"Mrs. Joe has been out a dozen times looking for you, Pip, and she's out now making it a baker's dozen."
"Has she been gone long, Joe?"
I always treated him as a larger species of child, and as no more than my equal. Joe glanced up at the clock.
"Well, she's been on the rampage this last spell about 5 minutes, Pip. Here, she's a-coming."
I got behind Joe as my sister, Mrs. Joe, threw the door wide open.
"Where have you been, you young monkey? Tell me directly what you've been doing to wear me away with fret and fright and worrit."
I've only been to the churchyard."
"Churchyard? If it weren't for me, you'd have been to the churchyard long ago and stayed there. Who brought you up by hand?"
"You did."
"And why did I do it, I should like to know?"
I whimpered.
I don't know."
"I don't. I'd never do it again, I know that. I may truly say I've never had this apron of mine off since born you were. It's bad enough to be a blacksmith's wife and him a gargery without being your mother. Ha! Churchyard indeed."
And Mrs. Joe applied herself to set the tea things. That day was Christmas Eve, and when later I was taking a final warm in the chimney corner before being sent up to bed, there was suddenly a noise in the distance.
"Hark! Was that great guns, Joe?"
"Ah, there's another convict off."
"What does that mean, Joe?"
Mrs. Joe, who always took explanations upon herself, said snappishly,
"Escaped! Escaped prison ships right across the marshes!"
I wonder who's put into the prison ships and why they're put there,
said I in a general way and with quiet desperation. It was too much for Mrs. Joe, who immediately rose.
I tell you what, young fellow, I didn't bring you up by hand to badger people's lives out. It would be blame to me and not praise if I had. People are put in the hulks because they murder and because they rob and forge and do all sorts of bad, and they always begin by asking questions. Now you get along to bed.
As soon as the great black velvet pall outside my little window was shot with grey, I got up and went downstairs. Every board upon the way and every crack in every board calling after me, "Stop, thief!" and "Get up, Mrs. Joe!" In the pantry I stole some bread, some rind of cheese, about half a jar of mincemeat, some brandy from a stone bottle, which I decanted into a smaller glass bottle, and lastly, a beautiful round, compact pork pie. There was a door in the kitchen communicating with the forge. I unlocked and unbolted the door and got a file from among Joe's tools. Then I put the fastenings as I had found them, opened the door at which I had entered when I ran home last night, shut it, and ran for the misty marshes. The mist was heavier yet when I got out upon the marshes. I knew my way to the battery and was very near that place when I saw the man sitting before me. His back was towards me, and he had his arms folded and was nodding forward, heavy with sleep. I went forward and touched him on the shoulder. He instantly jumped up, and it was not the same man, but another man. And yet this man was dressed in coarse grey too, and had a great iron on his leg. He swore an oath at me, made a hit at me that missed me, and then ran into the mist. "It's the young man," I thought, feeling my heart shoot as I identified him. I was soon at the battery after that. And there was the right man, hugging himself and limping to and fro, as if he had never all night left off hugging and limping, waiting for me. I opened my bundle and emptied my pockets. He was instantly handing mincemeat down his throat, only leaving off to take some of the liquor, staring distrustfully while he did so at the mist all round us. Pitying his desolation, and watching him as he gradually settled down upon the pie, I made bold to say,
"I am afraid you won't leave any of it for him."
"Leave any for him? Who's him?"
"The young man that you spoke of, that was hid with you."
Him? Yes, yes, he won't want no whittles."
"I thought he looked as if he did."
The man stopped eating and regarded me with the keenest scrutiny and the greatest surprise.
"Looked? When?"
"Just now."
"Where?"
"Yonder. Over there, where I found him nodding asleep and thought it was you."
He held me by the collar and stared at me.
Dressed like you, you know, only with a hat," I explained, trembling. And...
I was very anxious to put this delicately.
"And with the same reason for wanting to borrow a file."
"This man, did you notice anything in him?"
"He had a badly bruised face,"
said I, recalling what I hardly knew I knew.
"Not here."
And the man struck his left cheek mercilessly with the flat of his hand.
"Yes, there."
"Where is he?"
He crammed what little food was left into the breast of his grey jacket.
"Show me the way he went. I'll put him down like a bloodhound. Curse this iron on my sore leg. Give us hold of the file, boy."
I indicated in what direction the mist had shrouded the other man, and he looked up at it for an instant. But he was down on the rank, wet grass, filing at his iron like a madman. I told him I must go, but he took no notice, so I thought the best thing I could do was to slip off. The last I saw of him, his head was bent over his knee, and he was working hard at his fetter, muttering impatient imprecations at it and at his leg. The last I heard of him, I stopped in the mist to listen, and the file was still going. We were to have a superb Christmas dinner, consisting of a leg of pickled pork and greens and a pair of roast stuffed fowls. A handsome mince pie had been made yesterday morning, which accounted for the mincemeat not yet being missed, and the pudding was already on the boil. Mr. Wopsle, the clerk at the church, was to dine with us, and Uncle Pumblechook, Joe's uncle, but Mrs. Joe appropriated him, who was a well-to-do corn chandler in the nearest town.
Mrs. Joe,
said Uncle Pumblechook when he arrived at the forge, a large, hard-breathing, middle-aged, slow man, with a mouth like a fish and dull, staring eyes.
I have brought you, as the compliment of the season, I have brought you, Mum, a bottle of sherry wine, and I have brought you, Mum, a bottle of port wine.
Every Christmas Day he presented himself as a profound novelty with exactly the same words, and carrying the two bottles like dumbbells. Every Christmas Day, Mrs. Joe replied as she now replied,
Oh, Uncle Pumblechook, this is kind!
By degrees, I became calm enough to partake of the dinner. I began to think I should get over the day, when my sister said,
You must taste such a delightful and delicious present of Uncle Pumblechook's. It's a pie, a savoury pork pie.
My sister went out to get it. I heard her steps proceed to the pantry. I have never been absolutely certain whether I uttered a shrill yell of terror merely in spirit or in the bodily hearing of the company. I felt that I could bear it no more and that I must run away. But I ran no further than the house door, for there I ran into a party of soldiers with their muskets, one of whom held out a pair of handcuffs to me, saying,
Here you are. Look sharp. Come on.
The dinner party rose from the table in confusion, and Mrs. Joe, re-entering the kitchen empty-handed, stopped short and stared. The sergeant picked out Joe with his eye.
We've had an accident with these handcuffs, and I find the lock of one of them goes wrong and the coupling don't act pretty. As they are wanted for immediate service in the hunt for two escaped convicts, will you throw your eye over them?
Joe threw his eye over them and pronounced that the job would take nearer 2 hours than one.
Ah, will it? Then will you set about it at once, blacksmith?
At last the job was done, and as Joe got on his coat, he proposed that he and I should go down with the soldiers and see what came of the hunt. The soldiers were moving on in the direction of the old battery, and we were moving on a little way behind them, when all of a sudden we all stopped, for there had reached us on the wings of the wind and rain a long shout. Then one voice calling, Murder! And another voice,
Convicts! Runaways! Guard! This way for the runaway convicts!
Then both voices would seem to be stifled in a struggle, and then would break out again. The soldiers ran like deer, and Joe too, taking me with him.
Here are both men,
panted the sergeant, struggling at the bottom of a ditch.
Surrender, you two, and confound you for two wild beasts. Come asunder!
Water was splashing and mud was flying, and oaths were being sworn and blows were being struck, when some more men went down into the ditch to help the sergeant and dragged out separately my convict and the other one.
Mind,
said my convict, wiping blood from his face with his ragged sleeves and shaking torn hair from his fingers.
I took him. I give him up to you. Mind that.
The other convict was livid to look at.
Take notice, guard. He tried to murder me, were his first words.
Tried to murder him, said my convict disdainfully. Try and not do it. I took him and give him up. That's what I done. Now the hulks has got its gentleman again, through me. Murder him, when I could do worse and drag him back. Do you see what a villain he is? Do you see those grovelling and wandering eyes? That's how he looked when we were tried together. He never looked at me.
Enough of this parley. Light those torches.
As one of the soldiers complied, my convict looked round him for the first time and saw me. I looked at him eagerly when he looked at me, and slightly moved my hands and shook my head. I had been waiting for him to see me, that I might try to assure him of my innocence. My convict suddenly turned to the sergeant and remarked,
I wish to say something respecting this escape. It may prevent some persons laying under suspicion along o' me. I took some wittles up at the village over yonder.